damp of my palms, in the tenseness of the muscles at the back of my neck. The mate had lowered his telescope, but still looked toward the shore, almost absently, his hands resting on the rail. It occurred to me suddenly that if something drastic were to happen on land, the cruiser would at once lift sail and head out to sea, carrying the governor to safety, and me further from Jamie. Where on earth might we end up? Charleston? Boston? Either was as likely. And no one on that seething shore would have any notion where we had gone. I'd met displaced persons during the war. My war. Driven or taken from their homes, their families scattered, their cities destroyed. They thronged refugee camps, stood in lines besieging embassies and aid stations, asking, always asking for the names of the vanished, describing the faces of the loved and lost, grasping at any scrap of information that might lead them back to whatever might be left. Or, failing that, preserve for a moment longer what they had once been. The day was warm, even on the water, and my clothes clung to me with humid damp. But my muscles convulsed and my hands on the rail shook with sudden chill. I might have seen them all for the last time, not knowing it. Jamie, Bree, Jemmy, Roger, Ian. That's how it happened. I hadn't even said goodbye to Frank, had had no faintest inkling when he left that last night that I would never see him alive again. What if... But no, I thought, steadying myself with a tighter grip on the wooden rail. We would find each other again. We had a place to return to. Home. And if I remained alive, as I most firmly intended to do, I would go back home. The mate had shut his telescope and left. I hadn't noticed his departure, absorbed in morbid thoughts, and was quite startled when Major MacDonald hove to alongside me.
"Too bad the cruiser has nae long-range guns," he said, with a nod at the fort. "'Twould put a crimp in the plans of those wee heathen, aye?"
"Whatever those plans might be," I replied. "And speaking of plans..."
"I've a kind of a gripping in the wame," he interrupted blandly. "The governor suggested that you might possibly have some sort of medicine to soothe it."
"Did he indeed?" I said. "Well, come down to the galley. I'll brew you a cup of something that will set you right, I expect."
"Deacon, he thought you were a forger."
MacDonald, hands wrapped around a mug of tea, jerked his head in the direction of the main cabin. The governor was nowhere in sight, and the cabin's door closed.
"I did, yes."
"Does he know better now?" I asked with a sense of resignation.
"Well, I..." MacDonald looked apologetic. "I suppose he knew already, or I wouldn't have said. Though if I hadn't," he added, "he would have kent it sooner or later. The story's spread all the way to Edentown by now, and the broadsheets..."
I flapped a hand, dismissing this. "Have you seen Jamie?"
"I have not."
He glanced at me, curiosity warring with wariness.
"I'd heard... I've heard a great many things, and all different. But the meat of the matter is that you've both been arrested, aye? For the murder of Miss Christie."
I nodded briefly. I wondered whether one day I would grow used to that word. The sound of it was still like a punch in the stomach, short and brutal. "Need I tell you that there is no truth to it?" I said bluntly.
"Not the slightest need, mum,"
he assured me, with a fair assumption of confidence. But I sensed the hesitation in him, and saw the sideways glance, curious and somehow avid. Perhaps one day I'd get used to that, too. My hands were cold. I wrapped them round my own mug, taking what comfort I could in its heat. "I need to get word to my husband," I said. "Do you know where he is?" MacDonald's pale blue eyes were fixed on my face, his own showing no more now than courteous attention.
"No, mum. But you do, I assume?"
I gave him a sharp look.
Don't be coy, I advised him shortly. You know as well as I do what's going on shore. Probably much better.
Coy?
His thin lips pursed in brief amusement.
I don't believe anyone's called me that before. I knew. And so?
I think that he may be in Wilmington. I tried to send word to John Ash and asked him to get Jamie out of the jail in Wilmington, if possible, if he was there, and to tell him where I was. But I don't know. I waved a hand in frustration toward the shore. He nodded, native caution at odds with his obvious desire to ask me for the gory details of Malva's death.
I shall be going back through Wilmington. I'll make such inquiries as may be possible. If I find Mr. Fraser, shall I tell him anything beyond your present situation?
I hesitated, thinking. I'd been holding a constant conversation with Jamie ever since they took him away from me. But none of what I said to him in the wide black nights or the lonely dawns seemed appropriate to confide to MacDonald. And yet, I couldn't forego the opportunity. God knew when I might have another. "Tell him that I love him," I said softly, my eyes on the tabletop. "I always will." MacDonald made a small sound that made me look up at him.
"Even though he
began, then stopped himself. "He didn't kill her," I said sharply. "And neither did I. I told you so."
"Of course not,"
he said hurriedly.
"No one could imagine. I only meant—" "But of course a man's but a man, and—"
He broke off and looked away, the colour high in his face.
"He didn't do that, either," I said through my teeth.
There was a marked silence, during which we avoided each other's gaze. "Is General MacDonald a kinsman of yours?" I asked abruptly, needing either to change the course of the conversation or to leave. The Major glanced up, surprised and relieved.
"Aye, a distant cousin. The Governor's mentioned him."
"Yes," I said.
It was the truth, after all.
Martin simply hadn't mentioned the General to me.
"You're, assisting him, are you?
It sounds as though you've been having some success." Relieved to have escaped the social awkwardness of dealing with the question as to whether I were a murderess and Jamie only a philanderer, or he a murderer and I his scorned and deluded dupe, MacDonald was only too eager to take the offered bait.
"Great success, indeed," he said heartily. "I've gathered pledges from many of the most prominent men in the colony. They stand ready to do the Governor's bidding at the slightest word."
Jonathan McManus Boone, 3.
Prominent men.
I happen to know Jonathan McManus, whose gangrenous toes I had removed the winter before. He likely was the most prominent man in Boone, if by that MacDonald meant that the other 20 inhabitants all knew him for a drunkard and a thief. It was also probably true that he had 3 men who would go to fight with him if called, his one-legged brother and his 2 feeble-minded sons. I took a sip of tea to hide my expression. Still, MacDonald had Farquhar Campbell on his list. Had Farquhar really made a formal commitment?
"I gather the General isn't presently anywhere near Brunswick, though," I said, "given the, present circumstances."
If he was, the Governor would be much less nervous than he was. MacDonald shook his head.
"No, but he's not ready to muster his forces yet. He and MacLeod do but discover the readiness of the Highlanders to rise. They will not call muster until the ships come."
"Ships?" I blurted.
"What ships?"
He knew he oughtn't to speak further, but couldn't resist. I saw it in his eyes.
After all, what danger could there be in telling me?
"The Governor has asked for aid from the Crown in subduing the factionalism and unrest that runs rampant in the colony, and has received assurances that it will be forthcoming, should he be able to raise enough support on the ground to reinforce the government troops who will arrive by ship. That is the plan, you see," he went on, warming to it. "We are notified—" "Oh, we indeed," I thought, "that my Lord Cornwallis begins to gather troops in Ireland, who will take ship shortly, They should arrive in the early autumn and join with the General's militia. Between Cornwallis on the coast and the General coming Dunfrey the hills.
He closed thumb and fingers in a pinching movement.
They'll crush the Whiggish horsens like a pack of lice.
Will they?
I said, endeavouring to sound impressed. Possibly they would. I had no idea, nor did I much care, being in no position to see far beyond the present moment. If I ever got off this frigging boat and out of the shadow of a noose, I'd worry about it. The sound of the main cabin's door opening made me look up. The governor was closing it behind him. Turning, he saw us and came to inquire as to MacDonald's presumed indisposition.
"Oh, I'm a great deal better,"
the major assured him, hand pressed to the waistcoat of his uniform. He belched in illustration.
"Mrs. Fraser is a capital hand at such things. Capital."
"Oh, good," Martin said. He seemed a trifle less harassed than he had earlier.
"You will be wanting to go back, then."
He signalled to the marine standing at the foot of the companionway, who knuckled his forehead in acknowledgement and disappeared up the ladder.
"The boat will be ready for you in a few minutes' time."
With a nod at MacDonald's half-drunk tea and a punctilious bow to me, the governor turned and went into the surgeon's cabin, where I could see him standing beside the desk, frowning at the heap of crumpled papers. MacDonald hastily swallowed the rest of his tea, and with a lift of the eyebrows, invited me to accompany him to the upper deck. We were standing on deck, waiting as a local fishing boat made its way out to the cruiser from shore, when he suddenly laid a hand on my arm. This startled me. MacDonald was not a casual toucher.
"I will do my utmost to discover your husband's whereabouts, Mum," he said. "It occurs to me, though..."
He hesitated, eyes on my face. "What?" I said cautiously.
"I said I had heard considerable speculation," he said delicately, "regarding, the unfortunate demise of Miss Christie. Would it not be desirable that I know the truth of the matter, so that I might put any ill-natured rumours firmly to rest, should I encounter them?"
I was torn between anger and laughter. I should have known that curiosity would be too much for him. But he was right. Given the rumours I had heard, and I knew they were but a fraction of those circulating, the truth was certainly more desirable. On the other hand, I was entirely sure that the telling of the truth would do nothing to quell the rumours. And still, the urge to be justified was a strong one. I understood those poor wretches who cried their innocence from the gallows, and I bloody hoped I wasn't going to be one.
"Fine," I said crisply.
The first mate was back by the rail, keeping an eye on the fort and within earshot, but I supposed it didn't matter whether he heard. "The truth is this. Malva Christie was got with child by someone, but rather than name the real father, insisted that it was my husband. I know this to be false," I added, fixing him with a gimlet stare. He nodded, mouth a little open. "A few days later, I went out to tend my garden and found the little Miss Christie lying in my lettuce patch with her throat freshly cut. I thought there was some chance that I might save her unborn child." Despite my assumption of bravado, my voice trembled a little. I stopped, clearing my throat. "I couldn't. The child was born dead." Much better not to say how it was born. That weltering image of severed flesh and dirt-smeared blade was not one I wished the Major to have in mind, if it could be prevented. I had told no one, not even Jamie, about the faint flicker of life, that tingle that I still held secret in the palms of my hands. To say that the child had been born alive was to arouse immediate suspicion that I had killed it. And I knew as much. Some would think that anyway. Mrs. Martin plainly had. MacDonald's hand was still resting on my arm, his gaze on my face. For once I bless the transparency of my countenance. No one watching my face ever doubted what I said.
I see,
he said quietly, and gently squeezed my arm. I took a deep breath and told him the rest. Circumstantial details might convince some hearers. You know that there were bee gums at the edge of my garden? The murderer kicked two of them over in fleeing. He must have been stung several times. I was, when I came into the garden. Jamie had no stings. It wasn't him. And under the circumstances, I hadn't been able to find out which man or woman. For the first time, it occurred to me that it could have been a woman, had been stung. At this, he gave a deep hmm of interest. He stood for a moment in contemplation, then shook his head as though waking from a dream, and let go my arm.
I thank you, Mum, for telling me,
he said formally, and bowed to me.
Be assured, I will speak in your behalf whenever the occasion shall arise.
I appreciate that, Major.
My voice was husky, and I swallowed. I hadn't realized how much it would hurt to speak of. The wind stirred around us, and the reefed sails rustled in their ropes overhead. A shout from below announced the presence of the boat that would carry MacDonald back to the shore. He bowed low over my hand, breath warm on my knuckles. For an instant, my fingers tightened on his. I was surprisingly reluctant to let him go. But let him go, I did, and watched him all the way to the shore, a diminishing silhouette against the brightness of the water, back straight with resolution. He didn't look back. The mate moved at the rail, sighing, and I glanced at him, then at the fort.
What are they doing? I asked.
Some of the ant-like forms seemed to be dropping lines from the walks to their fellows on the ground. I saw ropes fine as spider-webs from this distance.
I do believe the fort's commander is preparing to remove the cannon, madam, he said, snapping shut his brass telescope with a click. If you will excuse me, I need to go inform the captain.
Chapter 96 Gunpowder Treason and Plot. If the governor's attitude toward me was altered by the news that I was not in fact a forger, but rather a notorious, if merely accused, murderess, I had no opportunity to find out. He, like the rest of the officers and half the men aboard, rushed to the rail, and the rest of the day passed in a flurry of observation, speculation, and largely fruitless activity. The lookout at the masthead called down periodic observations. Men were leaving the fort, carrying things. The fort's weaponry, it looked like.
"Are they Collet's men?"
the governor bellowed, shading his eyes to look aloft.
"Can't say, sir,"
came the unhelpful reply from above. At last, the cruiser's two launches were sent ashore, with orders to collect what information they could. They came back several hours later with the news that Collet had abandoned the fort in the face of threats, but had taken pains to remove the guns and powder, lest these fall into rebel hands.
No, sir, they had not spoken with Captain Collet, who was, by rumour, on his way upriver with his militia forces.
They had sent two men down the road toward Wilmington. It was true that a large force was gathering in the fields outside the town, under Colonels Robert Howe and John Ash, but no word of what was planned.
No word of what's planned, God's bollocks,
muttered the governor, having been ceremoniously informed of this by Captain Follard.
They mean to burn the fort. What else would Ash be planning, for the love of Jesus?
His instincts were quite sound. Just before sunset, the scent of smoke came across the water, and we could just make out the ant-like scurrying of men piling heaps of flammable debris around the base of the fort. It was a simple, square building made of logs, and despite the dampness of the humid air, it would burn eventually. It took them no little time to get the fire going, though, with neither powder nor oil to hasten its burning. As night fell, we could clearly see flaming torches streaming in the breeze as they were carried to and fro, passed from hand to hand, dipping to touch off a pile of kindling, coming back a few minutes later as the kindling went out. Around 9 o'clock, someone found a few barrels of turpentine, and the blaze took a sudden, lethal hold of the fort's log walls. Sheets of wavering flame rose, pure and brilliant, orange and crimson billows against the night-black sky, and we heard scraps of cheering and snatches of ribald song, borne with the smell of smoke and the tang of turpentine on the offshore breeze.
"At least we needn't worry about the mosquitoes," I observed, waving a cloud of whitish smoke away from my face.
"Thank you, Mrs. Fraser," said the Governor. "I had not considered that particular positive aspect of the matter."
He spoke with some bitterness, his fists resting impotently on the rail. I took the hint and said no more. For myself, the leaping flames and the column of smoke that rose wavering toward the stars were cause for celebration. Not for any benefit that the burning of Fort Johnston might be to the rebel cause, but because Jamie might be there, by one of the campfires that had sprung up on the shore below the fort. And if he was, he would come tomorrow. He did. I was awake well before dawn. In fact, I hadn't slept, and standing at the rail. There was little of the usual boat traffic this morning in the wake of the fort's burning. The bitter smell of wood ash mingled with the marshy smell of the nearby mud flats, and the water was still and oily-looking. It was a grey day, heavily overcast, and a deep bank of haze hung over the water, hiding the shore. I kept watching, though, and when a small boat came out of the haze, I knew at once that it was Jamie. He was alone. I watched the long, smooth reach of his arms and the pull of the oars and felt a sudden, deep, calm happiness. I had no notion what might happen, and all the horror and anger connected with Mulver's death still lurked at the back of my mind, a great dark shape under very thin ice. But he was there, near enough now to see his face as he looked back over his shoulder toward the ship. I lifted a hand to wave. His eyes were already fixed on me. He didn't stop rowing, but turned round and came on. I stood clinging to the rail, waiting. The rowboat passed out of sight for a moment under the lee of the cruiser, and I heard the watch hail him, the deep, half-audible answer, and felt something that had been knotted inside me for a long time let go at the sound of his voice. I stood rooted, though, not able to move. Then there were footsteps on deck and a murmur of voices, someone going to fetch the Governor. And I turned blindly into Jamie's arms. "Knew you'd come," I whispered into the linen of his shirt. He reeked of fire, smoke and pine sap and scorched cloth, and the bitter tang of turpentine, reeked of stale sweat and horses, the weariness of a man who hasn't slept, who has laboured all night, the faint, yeasty smell of long hunger. He held me close, ribs and breath and warmth and muscle, then put me away from him a little and looked down into my face. He had been smiling since I saw him. It lit his eyes, and without a word he pulled the cap off my head and threw it over the rail. He ran his hands through my hair, fluffing it out into abandon, then cupped my head in his hands and kissed me, fingers digging into my scalp. He had a 3-day beard which rasped my skin like sandpaper, and his mouth was home and safety. Somewhere behind him, one of the marines coughed and said loudly, "You wish to see the Governor, I believe, sir." He let go slowly and turned.
"I do indeed," he said,
and put out a hand to me.
"Sassenach?"
I took it and followed the marine heading for the companionway. I glanced back over the rail to see my cap bobbing in the swell, puffed with air, and tranquil as a jellyfish. The momentary illusion of peace vanished directly, though, once we were below. The Governor had been up most of the night as well, and didn't look much better than Jamie, though he was not, of course, besmeared with soot. He was, however, unshaven, bloodshot, and in no mood to be trifled with.
"Mr. Fraser," he said with a short nod, "you are James Fraser, I collect, and you dwell in the mountain back country?"
"I am the Fraser of Fraser's Ridge," Jamie said courteously, "and I have come for my wife."
"How have you?"
The governor gave him a sour look and sat down, gesturing indifferently at a stool.
"I regret to inform you, sir, that your wife is a prisoner of the Crown, though perhaps you were aware of this."
Jamie ignored this bit of sarcasm and took the proffered seat.
"In fact, she is not," he said.
"It is true, is it not, that you have declared martial law upon the colony of North Carolina?"
"It is," Martin said shortly.
This was rather a sore point, since while he had declared martial law, he was in no position actually to enforce it, but was obliged to float impotently offshore, fuming, until, and unless, England chose to send him reinforcements.
"Then, in fact, all customary legal usage is suspended," Jamie pointed out. "You alone have control over the custody and disposition of any prisoners, and my wife has, in fact, been in your custody for some little time. You, therefore, have also the power to release her."
"Hmm," said the governor.
Plainly he hadn't thought of that, and wasn't sure of its ramifications. At the same time, the notion that he was in control of anything at all at the moment was likely soothing to his inflamed spirits.
"She has not been committed for trial, and, in fact, there has been no evidence whatever adduced against her," Jamie said firmly.
I found myself uttering a silent prayer of thanks that I had told MacDonald the gory details after his visit with the governor. It might not be what a modern court called evidence, but being found with a knife in my hand and two warm, bloody corpses was very damned circumstantial.
"She is accused, but there is no merit to the charge.
Surely, having had her acquaintance for even so short a time as you have, you will have drawn your own conclusions as to her character."
Not waiting for an answer to this, he pressed on.
"When accusation was made, we did not resist the attempt to bring my wife or myself, for I also have been accused in the matter, to trial. What better indication is there that we should hold such conviction of her innocence as to wish for a speedy trial to establish it?"
The governor had narrowed his eyes and appeared to be thinking intently.
"Your arguments are not entirely lacking in virtue, sir," he said at last, with formal courtesy. "However, I understand that the crime of which your wife stands accused was a most heinous one. For me to release her must necessarily cause public outcry. And I have had rather enough of public unrest," he added, with a bleak look at the scorched cuffs of Jamie's coat.
Jamie took a deep breath and had another go.
"I quite understand Your Excellency's reservations," he said. "Perhaps some surety might be offered, which would overcome them."
Martin sat bolt upright in his chair, receding jaw thrust out.
"What do you suggest, sir? Have you the impertinence, the unspeakable bloody face to try to bribe me?"
He slapped both hands down on the desk and glared from Jamie to me and back.
"God damn it! I should hang the two of you out of hand."
"Very nice, Mr. Onat," I muttered to Jamie under my breath. "At least we're already married."
"Oh, ah," he replied,
giving me a brief glance of incomprehension before returning his attention to the governor, who was muttering,
"Swing them from the bloody yardarm, the infernal cheek of it, the creatures." "I had no such intent, sir."
Jamie kept his voice level, his eyes direct.
"What I offer is a bond, against my wife's appearance in court to answer the charge against her. When she does so appear, it will be returned to me."
Before the governor could respond to this, he reached into his pocket and withdrew something small and dark, which he set on the desk. The black diamond.
The sight of it stopped Martin in mid-sentence.
He blinked once, his long-nosed face going almost comically blank. He rubbed a finger slowly across his upper lip, considering. Having seen a great deal of the Governor's private correspondence and accounts by now, I was well aware that he had few private means and was obliged to live far beyond his modest income in order to maintain the appearances necessary for a royal governor. The Governor, in turn, was well aware that in the current state of unrest there was little chance of my being brought to trial in any sort of timely manner. It could be months and possibly years before the court system was restored to anything like routine function. And for however long it took, he would have the diamond. He couldn't in honour simply sell the thing, but could most assuredly borrow a substantial sum against it, in the reasonable expectation that he might redeem it later. I saw his eyes flicker toward the sooty marks on Jamie's coat, narrowing in speculation. There was also a good possibility of Jamie's being killed or arrested for treason. And I saw the impulse to do just that pop momentarily into his mind, which would leave the diamond perhaps in legal limbo, but certainly in Martin's possession. I had to force myself to keep on breathing. But he wasn't stupid, Martin, nor was he venal. With a small sigh, he pushed the stone back toward Jamie.
"No, sir," he said, though his voice had now lost its earlier outrage. "I will not accept this as bond for your wife. But the notion of surety..."
His gaze went to the stack of papers on his desk and returned to Jamie.
"I will make your proposition, sir," he said abruptly. "I have an action in train, an operation by which I hope to raise a considerable body of the Scottish Highlanders, who will march from the back country to the coast, there to meet with troops sent from England, and in the process to subdue the countryside on behalf of the king."
He paused for breath, eyeing Jamie closely to assess the effect of his speech. I was standing close behind Jamie and couldn't see his face, but didn't need to. Bree, joking, called it his brag face. No one looking at him would ever know whether he held four aces, a full house, or a pair of threes. I was betting on the pair of threes myself, but Martin didn't know him nearly as well as I did.
"General Hugh MacDonald and a Colonel Donald MacLeod came into the colony some time ago and have been traversing the countryside, rallying support, which they have gained in gratifying numbers, I'm pleased to say."
His fingers drummed briefly on the letters, then stopped abruptly as he leaned forward.
"What I propose, then, sir, is this. You will return to the back country and gather such men as you can. You will then report to General MacDonald and commit your troops to his campaign. When I receive word from MacDonald that you have arrived with, let us say, 200 men, then, sir, I will release your wife to you."
My pulse was beating fast, and so was Jamie's. I could see it throbbing in his neck. Definitely a pair of threes. Obviously, Major MacDonald hadn't had time to tell the governor, or hadn't known, just how widespread and acrimonious the response had been to Malva Christie's death. There were still men on the ridge who would follow Jamie, I was sure. But many more who would not. Or who would, but only if he repudiated me. I was trying to think logically about the situation as a means of distracting myself from the crushing disappointment of realizing that the governor was not going to let me go. Jamie must go without me. Leave me here. For an overwhelming instant I thought I couldn't bear it. I would run mad, scream, and leap across the desk to claw Josiah Martin's eyes out. He glanced up, caught a glimpse of my face, and started back, half rising from his chair. Jamie put back a hand and gripped my forearm hard.
"Be still, Anian," he said softly.
I'd been holding my breath without realizing it. Now I let it out in a gasp and made myself breathe slowly. Just as slowly, the governor, a wary gaze still fixed on me, lowered himself back into his seat. Clearly the accusation against me had just become a lot more likely in his mind. "Fine," I thought fiercely, to keep from crying. "See how easily you sleep, with me never more than a few feet away from you." Jamie drew a long, deep breath and his shoulders squared beneath his tattered coat.
"You will give me leave, sir, to consider your proposal," he said formally,
and, letting go of my arm, rose to his feet.
"Do not despair, Mukria," he said to me in Gaelic. "I will see you when the morning comes."
He lifted my hand to his lips and kissed it, then, with the barest of nods to the governor, strode out without looking back. There was an instant silence in the cabin, and I heard his feet going away, climbing the ladder of the companionway. I didn't pause to consider, but reached down into my stays and withdrew the small knife I had taken from the surgeon's kit. I jabbed it down with all my strength so that it stuck in the wood of the desk and stood there quivering before the governor's astonished eyes. "You fucking bastard," I said evenly, and left. Chapter 97. For the sake of one who is. I was waiting at the rail again before dawn the next day. The smell of ashes was strong and acrid on the wind, but the smoke had gone. An early morning haze still shrouded the shore, though, and I felt a small thrill of déjà vu mingled with hope as I saw the small boat come out of the mist, pulling slowly toward the ship. As it grew closer, though, my hands tightened on the rail. It wasn't Jamie. For a few moments I tried to convince myself that it was, that he had merely changed his coat. But with each stroke of the oars it became more certain. I closed my eyes, stinging with tears, all the while telling myself that it was absurd to be so upset. It meant nothing. Jamie would be here. He'd said so. The fact that someone else was coming early to the ship had nothing to do with him or me. It did, though. Opening my eyes and wiping them on my wrist, I looked again at the rowboat and felt a start of disbelief. It couldn't be. It was, though. He looked up at the watch's hail and saw me at the rail. Our eyes met for an instant. Then he bowed his head, reaching to the oars. Tom Christie. The governor was not amused at being roused from his bed at dawn for the third day running. I could hear him below ordering one of the marines to tell the fellow, whoever he was, to wait to a more reasonable hour. This followed by a peremptory slam of the cabin door. I wasn't amused either, and in no mood to wait. The marine, at the head of the companionway, refused to allow me below, though. Heart pounding, then, I turned and made my way to the stern, where they had put Christie to wait the governor's pleasure. The marine there hesitated, but after all, there were no orders to prevent me speaking with visitors. He let me pass. "Mr. Christie." He was standing at the rail, staring back at the coast, but turned at my words.
"Mrs. Fraser."
He was very pale. His grizzled beard stood out nearly black. He had trimmed it, though, and his hair as well. While he still looked like a lightning-blasted tree, there was life in his eyes once more when he looked at me. "My husband," I began, but he cut me off.
"He is well. He awaits you on the shore. You will see him presently."
"Oh?" The boil of fear and fury inside me reduced itself slightly, as though someone had turned down the flame. But a sense of impatience was still steaming. "Well, what in bloody hell is going on? Will you tell me that?" He looked at me for a long moment in silence, then licked his lips briefly, and turned to look over the rail at the smooth grey swell. He glanced back at me and drew a deep breath, obviously bracing himself for something.
"I have come to confess to the murder of my daughter."
I simply stared at him, unable to make sense of his words. Then I assembled them into a sentence, read it from the tablet of my mind, and finally grasped it. "No, you haven't," I said. The faintest shadow of a smile seemed to stir in his beard, though it vanished almost before I had seen it.
"You remain contrary, I see," he said dryly.
"Never mind what I remain," I said, rather rudely. "Are you insane? Or is this Jamie's latest plan? Because if so, He stopped me, with a hand on my wrist. I started at the touch, not expecting it.
"It is the truth," he said, very softly, "and I will swear to it by the Holy Scriptures."
I stood looking at him, not moving. He looked back directly, and I realized suddenly how seldom he had ever met my eyes. All through our acquaintance he had glanced away, avoided my gaze as though he sought to escape any real acknowledgement of me, even when obliged to speak to me. Now that was gone, and the look in his eyes was nothing I had ever seen before. The lines of pain and suffering cut deep around them, and the lids were heavy with sorrow. But the eyes themselves were deep and calm as the sea beneath us. The sense he had carried through our nightmare journey south, that atmosphere of mute horror, numb pain, had left him, replaced by resolve and something else, something that burned far down in his depths. "Why?" I said at last, and he let go his grip on my wrist, stepping back a pace.
"Do you remember once?" From the reminiscent tone of his voice, it might have been decades before. He asked me, "Did I think you a witch?"
"I remember," I replied guardedly. "You said..."
Now I remember that conversation all right, and something small and icy fluttered at the base of my spine. "You said that you believed in witches all right, but you didn't think I was one."
He nodded, dark grey eyes fixed on me. I wondered whether he was about to revise that opinion, but apparently not.
"I believe in witches," he said, with complete matter-of-fact seriousness. "For I've kent them. The girl was one, as was her mother before her."
The icy flutter grew stronger. "The girl," I said.
"You mean your daughter,
Malva?" He shook his head a little, and his eyes took on a darker hue.
"No daughter of mine," he said.
Not yours? But her eyes. She had your eyes." I heard myself say it and could have bitten my tongue. He only smiled, though, grimly.
"And my brother's?"
He turned to the rail, put his hands on it, and looked across the stretch of sea toward land.
"Edgar was his name. When the rising came and I declared for the Stuarts, he would have none of it, seeing it was folly. He begged me not to go."
He shook his head slowly, seeing something in memory that I knew wasn't the wooded shore.
"I thought, well, it doesn't matter what I thought, but I went and asked him, would he mind my wife and the wee lad?"
He drew a deep breath, let it slowly out.
"And he did."
"I see," I said, very quietly. He turned his head sharply at the tone of my voice, grey eyes piercing.
"It was not his fault. Muna was a witch, an enchantress."
His lips compressed at the expression on my face.
"You don't believe me, I see. It is the truth. More than once I caught her at it, working her charms, observing times. I came once to the roof of the house at midnight searching for her. I saw her there, stark naked and staring at the stars, standing in the centre of a pentacle she'd drawn with the blood of a strangled dove, and her hair flying loose, mad in the wind."
"Her hair," I said, looking for some thread to grasp in this, and suddenly realising. "She had hair like mine, didn't she?" He nodded, looking away, and I saw his throat move as he swallowed.
"She was what she was," he said softly. "I tried to save her, by prayer, by love. I could not."
"What happened to her?"
I asked, keeping my voice as low as his.
With the wind as it was, there was little chance of our being overheard here, but this was not the sort of thing I thought anyone should hear. He sighed and swallowed again.
"She was hanged,"
he said, sounding almost matter-of-fact about it.
"For the murder of my brother."
This, it seemed, had happened while Tom was imprisoned at Ardsmuir. She had sent him word before her execution, telling him of Mulver's birth, and that she was confiding care of the children to Edgar's wife.
"I suppose she thought that funny," he said, sounding abstracted. "She'd the oddest sense of humour, Moona had."
I felt cold beyond the chill of the early morning breeze and hugged my elbows. "But you got them back, Alan and Mulver." He nodded. He had been transported, but had the good fortune to have his indenture bought by a kind and wealthy man who had given him the money for the children's passage to the colonies. But then both his employer and the wife he had taken here had died in an epidemic of the yellow fever, and casting about for some new opportunity, he had heard of Jamie Fraser's settling in North Carolina, and that he would help those men he had known in Ardsmuir to land of their own.
"I would to God I had cut my own throat before I came," he said, turning back abruptly to me. "Believe me in that."
He seemed entirely sincere. I didn't know what to say in response, but he seemed to require none, and went on.
"The girl, she was no more than 5 years old when I first saw her. But already she had it. The same slyness, the charm, the same darkness of soul."
He had tried to the best of his ability to save Mulver as well, to beat the wickedness out of her, to constrain the streak of wildness. Above all, to keep her from working her wiles upon men.
"Her mither had that too."
His lips tightened at the thought.
"Any man. It was the curse of Lilith that they had. The both of them."
I felt a hollowness in the pit of my stomach as he came back now to the matter of Mulver. "But she was with child," I said. His face paled further, but his voice was firm.
"Aye, she was. I do not think it wrong to prevent yet another witch from entering the world."
Seeing my face, he went on before I could interrupt.
"You ken she tried to kill you. You and me both."
"What do you mean? Tried to kill me? How?"
"When you told her about the invisible things, the germs. She took great interest in that. She told me when I caught her wi' the bones."
"What bones?" I asked, a sliver of ice running down my back.
"The bones she took from Ephron's grave to work her charms upon your husband. She didn't use them all, and I found them in her workbasket later. I beat her badly, and she told me then."
Accustomed to wander alone in the woods in search of food, plants and herbs, she'd been doing so during the height of the dysentery epidemic, and in her wanderings had come upon the isolated cabin of the Sin-Eater, that strange, damaged man. She had found him near death, burning with fever, and sunk in coma. And while she stood there, undecided whether to run for help or only run, he had, in fact, died. Whereupon, seized by inspiration, and bearing my careful teachings in mind, she had taken mucus and blood from the body and put it into a little bottle with a bit of broth from the kettle on the hearth, nurturing it inside her stays with the warmth of her own body, and had slipped a few drops of this deadly infusion into my food and that of her father, in the hope that if we fell sick, our deaths would be seen as no more than a part of the sickness that plagued the ridge. My lips felt stiff and bloodless.
"You're sure of this?" I whispered.
He nodded, making no effort to convince me, and that alone gave me conviction that he spoke the truth.
"She wanted Jamie?" I asked.
He closed his eyes for a moment. The sun was coming up, and while the brilliance of it was behind us, the gleam off the water was bright as silver plate.
"She wanted," he said at last. "She lusted. Lusted for wealth, for position, for what she saw as freedom. Not seeing it as license. Never seeing."
He spoke with sudden violence, and I thought it wasn't Mulver alone who had never seen things as he did. But she had wanted Jamie, whether for himself or only for his property. And when her love charm failed, and the epidemic of sickness came, had taken a more direct way toward what she wanted. I couldn't yet find a way to grasp that, and yet I knew it was true. And then, finding herself inconveniently with child, she had come up with a new scheme. "Do you know who the father really was?" I asked, my throat tightening again. I thought it always would, at the memory of the sunlit garden and the two neat small bodies, ruined and wasted. Such a waste. He shook his head but wouldn't look at me, and I knew that he had some idea, at least. He wouldn't tell me, though, and I supposed it didn't matter just now. And the governor would be up soon, ready to receive him. He, too, heard the stirrings down below and took a deep breath.
I could not let her destroy so many lives, could not let her go on. For she was a witch, make no mistake. That she failed to kill either you or me was no more than luck. She would have killed someone before she finished. Perhaps you, if your husband clung to you. Perhaps him, in the hope of inheriting his property for the child.
He took a ragged, painful breath.
She was not born of my loins, and yet she was my daughter, my blood. I could not allow. I was responsible.
He stopped, unable to finish. In this, I thought, he told the truth. And yet...
Thomas, I said firmly, this is twaddle, and you know it.
He looked at me, surprised, and I saw that tears stood in his eyes. He blinked them back and answered fiercely,
Say you so. You know nothing. Nothing.
He saw me flinch and looked down. Then awkwardly he reached out and took my hand. I felt the scars of the surgery I had done, the flexible strength of his gripping fingers.
I have waited all my life in a search.
He waved his free hand vaguely, then closed his fingers as though grasping the thought, and continued more surely.
No, in hope. In hope of a thing I could not name, but that I knew must exist.
His eyes searched my face, intent, as though he memorized my features. I raised a hand, uncomfortable under this scrutiny, intending, I suppose, to tidy my mad hair. But he caught my hand and held it, surprising me.
Leave it, he said.
Standing with both hands in his, I had no choice. Thomas, I said, uncertain. Mr. Christie.
I became convinced that it was God I sought. Perhaps it was. But God is not flesh and blood, and the love of God alone could not sustain me. I have written down my confession.
He let go and poked a hand into his pocket, fumbling a little, and pulled out a folded paper, which he clutched in his short, solid fingers.
I have sworn here that it was I who killed my daughter, for the shame she had brought upon me by her wantonness.
He spoke firmly enough, but I could see the working of his throat above the wilted stalk.
You didn't, I said positive. I know you didn't.
He blinked, gazing at me.
No, he said, quite matter-of-fact. But perhaps I should have. I have written a copy of this confession, he said, tucking the document back into his coat. And have left it with a newspaper in New Bern. They will publish it. The governor will accept it. How can he not?
And you will go free. Those last four words struck me dumb. He was still gripping my right hand, his thumb stroked gently over my knuckles. I wanted to pull away, but forced myself to keep still, compelled by the look in his eyes, clear grey and naked now, without disguise.
I have yearned always, he said softly, for love given and returned. Have spent my life in the attempt to give my love to those who were not worthy of it. Allow me this, to give my life for the sake of one who is.
I felt as though someone had knocked the wind from me. I hadn't any breath, but struggled to form words.
Mr. Tom,
I said. You mustn't. Your life has value. You can't throw it away like this. He nodded, patient.
I knew that. If it did not, this would not matter.
Feet were coming up the companionway, and I heard the governor's voice below, in cheerful conversation with the captain of marines. Thomas, don't do this. He only looked at me and smiled. Had I ever seen him smile? But didn't speak. He raised my hand and bent over it. I felt the prickle of his beard and the warmth of his breath, the softness of his lips.
I am your servant, madam, he said, very softly.
He squeezed my hand and released it, then turned and glanced toward the shore. A small boat was coming, dark against the glitter of the silver sea.
Your husband is coming for you. Adieu, Mrs. Fraser.
He turned and walked away, back steady in spite of the swell that rose and fell beneath us. Part 11. In the Day of Vengeance. Chapter 98. To Keep a Ghost at Bay. Jamie groaned, stretched, and sat down heavily on the bed.
I feel as though someone stepped on my cock.
Oh? I opened one eye to look at him. Who? He gave me a bloodshot look.
I dunno ken, but it feels as though it was someone heavy.
Lie down, I said, yawning. We haven't got to leave right away. You can rest a bit more. He shook his head.
Nee, I want to be home. We've been gone too long as it is.
Nonetheless, he didn't get up and finish dressing, but continued to sit on the sway-backed in-bed in his shirt, big hands hanging idle between his thighs. He looked tired to death, in spite of just having risen, and no wonder. I didn't think he could have slept at all for several days, what with his search for me, the burning of Fort Johnston, and the events attending my release from the cruiser. Remembering, I felt a pall settle over my own spirits, in spite of the joy in which I had awakened, realizing that I was free, on land, and with Jamie. Lie down, I repeated. I rolled toward him and put a hand on his back. It's barely dawn. At least wait for breakfast. You can't travel without rest or food. He glanced at the window, still shuttered. The cracks had begun to pale with the growing light. But I was right. There was no sound below of fires being stoked or pots banged in preparation. Capitulating suddenly, he collapsed slowly sideways, unable to repress a sigh as his head settled back on the pillow. He didn't protest when I flung the ratty quilt over him, nor yet when I curved my body to fit round him, wrapping an arm about his waist and laying my cheek against his back. He still smelled of smoke, though both of us had washed hastily the night before falling into bed and a dearly bought oblivion. I could feel how tired he was. My own joints still ached with fatigue, and from the lumps in the flattened, wool-stuffed mattress. Ian had been waiting with horses when we came ashore, and we had ridden as far as we could before darkness fell, finally fetching up at a ramshackle inn in the middle of nowhere, a crude roadside accommodation for wagoneers on their way to the coast.
Malcolm, he said, with the slightest of hesitations when the innkeeper had asked his name. Alexander Malcolm.
And Murray,
Ian had said, yawning and scratching his ribs. John Murray.
The innkeeper had nodded, not particularly caring. There was no reason why he should associate three nondescript, bedraggled travellers with a notorious case of murder. And yet I had felt panic well up under my diaphragm when he glanced at me. I had sensed Jamie's hesitation in giving the name, his distaste for reassuming one of the many aliases he had once lived under. More than most men, he valued his name. I only hoped that given time, it would once more have value. Roger might help. He would be a full-fledged minister by now, I thought, smiling at the thought. He had a true gift for soothing the divisions among the inhabitants of the ridge, easing acrimony, and having the additional authority of being an ordained minister, his influence would be increased. It would be good to have him back, and to see Bree and Jemmy again. I had a moment's longing for them, though we would see them soon. We meant to go through Cross Creek and collect them on the way. But of course, neither Bree nor Roger had any notion what had happened in the last 3 weeks, nor what life might now be like in the wake of it. The birds were in full voice in the trees outside. After the constant screeching of gulls and terns that formed the background of life on the cruiser, the sound of them was tender, a homely conversation that made me long suddenly for the ridge. I understood Jamie's strong urge to be home, even knowing that what we would find there wasn't the same life we had left. The Christies would be gone, for one thing. I hadn't had the chance to ask Jamie about the circumstances of my rescue. I had finally been put ashore just before sunset, and we had ridden off at once, Jamie wanting to put as much distance as possible between me and Governor Martin, and perhaps Tom Christie. "Jamie," I said softly, my breath warm in the folds of his shirt. "Did you make him do it?" "Tom?"
"No."
His voice was soft, too.
"He came to Fergus's print shop the day after you left the palace. He'd heard that the jail had burned."
I sat up in bed, shocked. "What? Sheriff Tolliver's house? No one told me that." He rolled onto his back, looking up at me.
"I didn't suppose anyone you've spoken to in the last week or two would know," he said mildly. "No one was killed, Sassenach," I asked.
"You're sure of it?" I asked, with uneasy thoughts of Sadie Ferguson. "How did it happen? A mob?"
"No," he said, yawning. "From what I hear, Mrs. Tolliver got stinking drunk, stoked her laundry fire too high, then lay down in the shade and fell asleep. The wood collapsed, the embers set fire to the grass, it spread to the house, and..."
He flipped a hand in dismissal.
"The neighbours smelt smoke, though, and rushed over in time to drag Mrs. Tolliver and the bairns safe away. He said there was no one else in the place."
"Oh, well." I let him persuade me to lie down again, my head resting in the hollow of his shoulder. I couldn't feel strange with him, not after spending the night pressed close against him in the narrow bed, each of us aware of the other's every small movement. Still, I was very conscious of him. And he of me. His arm was round me, his fingers unconsciously exploring the length of my back, lightly reading the shapes of me like Braille as he talked.
"So then, Tom. He kent about the onion, of course, and so went there when he found you disappeared from the jail. By then, of course, you'd gone from the palace as well. It had taken him some time to part company with Richard Brown without rousing his suspicions. But he found us there, and he told me what he meant to do."
His fingers stroked the back of my neck, and I felt the tightness there begin to relax.
"I told him to bide. I should have a go at getting you back on my own, but if I could not..."
"So you know he didn't do it?" I spoke with certainty. "Did he tell you he had?"
"He only said that he had kept silent while there was any chance of you being tried and acquitted, but that had you ever seemed in urgent danger, then he meant to speak up at once. That's why he insisted upon coming with us. I didn't wish to ask him questions," he said delicately.
"But he didn't do it," I prodded insistent. "Jamie, you know he didn't." I felt the rise of his chest under my cheek as he breathed.
"I know," he said softly.
We were silent for a bit. There was a sudden muffled rapping outside and I jerked. But it was only a woodpecker, hunting insects in the wormy timbers of the inn. "Will they hang him, do you think?" I asked at last, staring up at the splintered beams above.
"I expect they will, I."
His fingers had resumed their half-unconscious motion, smoothing strands of my hair behind my ear. I lay still, listening to the slow thump of his heart, not wanting to ask what came next. But I had to. "Jamie, tell me that he didn't do it, that he didn't make that confession for me, please." I didn't think I could bear that, not on top of everything else.
His fingers stilled, just touching my ear.
He loves you. You ken that, eh?
He spoke very quietly.
I heard the reverberation of the words in his chest, as much as the words themselves.
He said he did.
I felt a tightness in the throat, recalling that very direct grey look. Tom Christie was a man who said what he meant, and meant what he said. A man like Jamie, in that regard, at least.
Jamie was quiet for what seemed a long time. Then he sighed and turned his head so his cheek rested against my hair.
I heard the faint rasp of his whiskers. Sassenach, I would have done the same and counted my life well lost if it saved you. If he feels the same, then you've done nae wrong to him to take your life from his hand.
Oh, dear, I said. Oh, dear.
I didn't want to think of any of it. Not Tom's clear grey look and the calling of gulls. Not the lines of affliction that carved his face into pieces. Not the thought of what he had suffered in loss, in guilt, in suspicion, in fear. Nor did I want to think of Mulvaugh going unwitting to that death among the Lettuces, her son heavy and peaceful in her womb. Nor the dark, rusty blood drying in gouts and splashes among the leaves of the grapevines. Above all, I didn't want to think that I had had any part in this tragedy, but that was inescapable. I swallowed, hard.
Jamie, can it ever be made right?
He held my hand now in his other hand, stroking his thumb gently back and forth under my fingers.
The lass is dead, Mochia.
I closed my hand on his thumb, stilling it.
Yes, and someone killed her, and it wasn't Tom.
Oh, God, Jamie, who? Who was it?
I dinna ken, he said,
and his eyes grew deep with sadness.
She was a lass who craved love, I think, and took it. But she didna ken how to give it back again.
I took a deep breath and asked the question that had lain unspoken between us since the murder.
You don't think it was Ian?
He nearly smiled at that.
If it had been an Ian, we'd know. Ian could kill. He couldn't let you or me suffer for it.
I sighed, shifting my shoulders to ease the knot between them. He was right, and I felt comforted on Ian's account, and still more guilty on Tom Christie's.
The man who fathered her child, if that wasn't Ian, and I so hope it wasn't, or someone who wanted her and killed her from jealousy when he found she was pregnant.
Or someone already wed. Or a woman, Sassenach.
That stopped me cold. A woman?
She took love, he repeated, and shook his head. What makes you think it was only the young men she took it from?
I closed my eyes, envisioning the possibilities. If she had had an affair with a married man, and they had looked at her too, only more discreetly. Yes, he might have killed her to keep it undiscovered. Or a scorned wife.
I had a brief, shocking glimpse of Merdina Bug, face contorted with effort as she pressed the pillow over Lionel Brown's face.
Arch? God, no!
Once again, with a sense of utter hopelessness, I turned away from the question, seeing in mind the myriad faces of Fraser's Ridge, one of them hiding a murderer's soul.
No, I know it can't be fixed for them, not Mulvaugh or Tom, or even Alan.
For the first time I spared a thought for Tom's son, so suddenly bereft of his family and in such dreadful circumstances.
But the rest...
The Ridge, I meant. Home. The life we had had. Us. It had grown warm under the quilt, lying together, too warm, and I felt the heat of a hot flush wash over me. I sat up abruptly, throwing off the quilt, and leaned forward, lifting the hair off my neck in hopes of an instant's coolness.
Stand up, Sassenach.
Jamie rolled out of bed, stood up, and took me by the hand, pulling me to my feet. Sweat had already broken out on my body like dew, and my cheeks were flushed. He bent, and taking the hem of my shift in both hands, stripped it off over my head. He smiled faintly, looking at me, then bent and blew softly over my breasts. The coolness was a tiny but blessed relief, and my nipples rose in silent gratitude. He opened the shutters for more air, then stepped back and pulled off his own shirt. Day had broken fully now, and the flood of pure morning light glimmered on the lines of his pale torso, on the silver web of his scars, the red-gold dusting of hair on his arms and legs,